Well, thank you, everyone, and that's not what I thought was going to happen when I started to speak. But anyway, we are on a university campus, and I'm pleased to hear that there is still some activism that goes on, even if it's at my expense. First of all, thank you for the invitation, Selwyn, to deliver this Sir Leslie Melville lecture tonight. As actually was set out in the introduction, Melville is, of course, renowned for his contribution to the establishment of central banking in Australia. But just listening to his contribution broadly, he was a very, very distinguished man. On central banking, it is a very challenging time at the moment. We're trying to return inflation to target in a reasonable time frame and to preserve gains in the labour market. And that's something I'm sure that Melville would have approved of. I'll actually have plenty of opportunities to address these issues over the months ahead, but in the memorial lecture today, before I take up the position of Governor, I would like to address another critical issue regarding the future, and that's climate change. And particularly, I want to talk about climate change and the implications for the economy and monetary policy. So right up to the end of his long life, Melville was an avid consumer of news, not only economic and financial news, but also scientific news. He was noted, I think Selwyn's noted in articles, that he was prepared to speak on contemporary policy issues, including those for which solutions were very difficult and opinions were divided. So I therefore think Melville would have been very engaged with the issues that I'll be addressing in this lecture. Now, there's another more personal reason that I feel particularly pleased to be giving this lecture. As you know, I was recently appointed the next Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, and I am the first female to hold this position. But from what I know of Sir Leslie Melville, he was ahead of his time in terms of recognising women economists. Soon after he was appointed the bank's first economist in 1931, he made the rather progressive move of recruiting Mary Wilmot Debenham as the bank's assistant economist. In what was standard practice at the time, Ms. Debenham had to resign after she married. But I nevertheless like to think that Melville would be very pleased to see that a woman has now become the governor, and that there are many excellent female economists, not only in the Reserve Bank, but across the Australian public service. So I think, for me, it feels quite special in this context. So, as I said, I want to talk about climate change and central banks. It's my little clicker. So, like the rest of the world, Australia's climate's changing. In recent years, it's been warmer than any multi-year period on record, with more days of extreme heat and intense rainfall events. In coming decades, Australia is projected to experience further increases in temperatures and intense rainfall events, while some parts of the country will receive less rainfall. Policymakers, businesses and households here and overseas are increasingly taking actions to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. There's around 150 countries now pledged to reach net zero emissions, whereby emissions produced and emissions removed from the atmosphere are in balance. And these 150 countries make up around 92% of global GDP, and they contribute 88% of total emissions. So this is quite substantial. Climate change and the actions taken in response are going to have broad-ranging implications for the economy, for the financial system, and for society at large. As the review of the Reserve Bank, which was released earlier this year, has helpfully reinforced, climate change will have implications for price stability, for employment and stability of the financial system. And as such, it's worth discussing how the bank is considering the impacts of climate change on our policy mandates. So I'm going to start by discussing how more frequent and severe weather events and the global transition to net zero could affect the setting of monetary policy. I'll then talk about how we're monitoring the impact of climate change as it relates to financial stability and the work underway by the Australian financial regulators to help financial markets and institutions manage climate risks and opportunities. So, navigating uncertainty is an inherent part of the work of a central bank. But the uncertainty around climate change is particularly acute. There's not only uncertainty around how the climate itself will change, but there's also uncertainty around how this will affect the economy and the financial system. The timing and the intensity of the effects are uncertain, and these could be severe and irreversible if tipping points are reached. In addition, it's unclear how the policies, preferences, and technologies associated with climate mitigation will evolve. I think many of you will probably know that economic and financial risks arising from climate change are typically divided into two types. We talk about physical risks, including both the impact of more frequent and extreme weather events such as fires, floods, droughts, and cyclones, as well as gradually emerging effects on temperature, rainfall, and sea level. And then there's transition risks. And these arise from actions taken in response to climate change. They could include policy actions, technological innovation, or people's preferences both here and overseas. Actions taken to address climate change will ultimately reduce physical risks, but their timing and sequencing could increase some transition risks associated with a move to a lower emissions economy. Now, these climate risks will affect the economy through several channels. Hotter temperatures and more extreme weather will disrupt businesses, they'll damage property and lower productivity growth. Actions taken to reduce emissions might present adjustment costs, but they'll also present opportunities. Indeed, while there's much uncertainty in this area, there is general agreement that a timely and orderly transition will be the less costly approach in the long run. So what about the bank and monetary policy? Well, as many of you will know, the bank sets monetary policy according to a flexible inflation target, and we aim to get it between 2 and 3%. So to consider the implications of climate change for monetary policy, the bank needs to understand how the physical effects of a changing climate and the transition to a low emissions economy will affect inflation and its determinants. Many of the physical and transition impacts of climate change affect the supply side of the economy. While monetary policy primarily works by influencing the level of demand and expectations of inflation, supply side developments do also need to be considered. As well as short-term effects on supply, climate change might also have an impact on longer-run concepts like potential output and the neutral real interest rate, which can help to form decisions, which can help us to inform assessments about the appropriate stance of monetary policy. So to illustrate these points, I'm going to step through some examples of how physical and transition risks are affecting the economy and how we might think about these from the perspective of monetary policy. So in the short run, many of the physical effects of climate change can be treated as a negative supply shock. The standard view is that monetary policy should largely look through short-term supply shocks. For example, inclement weather might disrupt production or supply chains, resulting in a temporary increase in prices. But then weather conditions improve, production recovers, and the impact on prices wanes. If inflation expectations remain anchored, inflation should return to target when the shock dissipates. However, if the disruptions become more frequent, more severe, or perhaps more protracted due to climate change, prices could become more volatile, or if there's persistent adverse effects on productive capacity, prices could remain higher for longer. The longer inflation is allowed to remain high, the greater the risk that expectations will drift higher, and the greater the real economic costs will be of bringing inflation back down. Now, at the bank, we're familiar with thinking about the impact of natural disasters on the economy and the implications of that for monetary policy. The statement on monetary policy, which is one of our flagship publications, over the years has included boxes on the impact of flooding in 2011 and 2022, and the impact of droughts and bushfires in 2020. So what we do in these documents is we document the effects of these events on the farm sector and the production of commodities, on transport and logistics, as well as destruction of homes, businesses and infrastructure. Looking at past episodes for agricultural production, as an example, shows that some supply shocks dissipate quickly, while others can be more persistent. In general, agricultural production is well diversified across Australia. Production cycles are short, and there are alternative sources to be drawn upon. So it's actually quite rare for a single commodity to suffer a prolonged large loss of supply and to have a persistent impact on prices. That said, the spike in banana prices following Cyclone Larry in 2006 and Cyclone Yasi in 2011 temporarily boosted measured inflation by around 0.7 percentage points on each occasion. I can remember how costly bananas were at the time. This happened because bananas are mostly grown only in a few areas in North Queensland. They have a relatively long production cycle and they're not imported. On a longer and more widespread scale, drought conditions between 2018 and 2020 saw many parts of the country experience high temperatures and well below average rainfall. This reduced the domestic supply of some food items, placing upward pressure on cereal, milk, and meat prices. So these are all examples about cycles in the weather. Climate change, however, is a trend change. Longer run shifts in temperature and changes in water availability are likely to have implications for the viability of agriculture in some regions and for some crop types. So physical risks, even though we've seen them in these cycles, physical risks from climate change may lead to structural changes in industry composition. So extreme weather events, though, I've talked about the supply side, extreme weather events can also affect aggregate demand. Temporary disruptions or related uncertainty associated with that might lead to lower investment or household spending for a time, although spending could rebound if there's a need to rebuild infrastructure or residential or commercial property. But this in turn could divert investment from potentially more productive opportunities that could have been pursued in the absence of disruption. More extreme weather events could also lower employment if physical assets are destroyed and the capital stock is reduced. Higher temperatures could adversely affect the health of workers, particularly those working outdoors, and so that could weigh on productivity. Unemployment could be persistently higher if people are unable or unwilling to leave a region that has suffered from extreme weather and related job losses. It's really important to point out here that climate impacts vary significantly across regions. So an impact might be small in aggregate, but it might be really extreme for a local community. Now, I want to turn now to transition risks. The idea of mitigating climate change by putting in place policies to reduce emissions will impact the prices faced by households and businesses. This will lead to structural shifts in output and employment as some carbon-intensive economic activities become unprofitable and others eventually take their place. How smoothly these changes occur will be an important context for monetary policy. I think it's important to note that monetary policy is not a driver of this transition. Fiscal and regulatory policies are better suited to the task of facilitating the transition to a low emissions economy. The most helpful contribution that monetary policy can make is to focus on maintaining stable long-term inflation expectations. This approach recognises the flexibility embedded in our inflation target, which means that monetary policy doesn't need to overreact to short-lived price shocks. The implications of the transition for the economy will depend on the specific policy measures put in place, changes in consumer preferences, the availability of technologies, and the timing and speed of the process. The phase-out of carbon-intensive production may reduce aggregate supply temporarily, but investment in alternative production methods will boost aggregate demand. Depending on how this transition plays out, if the net effect is to temporarily lower aggregate supply, then this is going to put upward pressure on inflation. So to illustrate the possible economic impacts of the transition, I want to consider developments in electricity generation. Globally, policies are being put in place to lower emissions, which will make it more expensive to use fossil fuels to produce electricity. In addition to this, the costs of wind and solar-generated electricity have decreased markedly over the past decade. As a result, renewables generation is growing rapidly, although from a very low base. In Australia, electricity generated by renewables, so hydro, wind and solar, has increased almost sixfold since 2006. The share of electricity generated from fossil fuels has declined from around 90% in 2010 to around 65% today. Coal-fired power plants are scheduled to be shut down over the next three decades. Now, this could put upward pressure on energy prices if coal plant closures are not matched by renewables supply and storage. And there is much uncertainty here. In recent years, some plants have brought forward their planned closure dates. And looking forward, coal plant closures might be delayed to ensure electricity generation is sufficient to meet demand. But this comes with other risks. For example, coal plants may be more prone to outages as the infrastructure ages. Furthermore, slower coal plant closures would require more rapid reductions in emissions in other sectors if we're going to meet national emissions targets. So there are potential flow-on effects. Shifting the mix of energy generation to a higher share of renewables also has flow-on effects. Renewable energy generation in Australia is weather dependent, and it's often best located in more remote parts of the country. So, alongside with the large amount of investment required to generate electricity from wind and solar and hydro, investment and innovation will also be needed in energy storage and other firming capacity to upgrade, extend, and adapt the transmission network in Australia. This investment is going to require a large workforce and a range of specialist skills. The extent of the investment required is uncertain because it depends on the pace and ambition of Australia's transition path, and also because the cost for inputs could change considerably over time. New technologies are also likely to emerge that could reduce costs and increase efficiencies. The public estimates for the investment needed in Australia over coming decades vary quite markedly, but they are all very large. It's important to note that Australia's transition will also occur in the context of a global transition, with all countries drawing on similar materials and labour skills and at an increasing pace. To achieve net zero emissions globally, the International Energy Agency estimates that by 2030, annual investment in clean energy will have to be running at around three times the current pace, which has already increased substantially in recent years. If realised, this is expected to have some sizeable and possibly volatile effects on overall inflation. On the other hand, some have made the argument that rapid adoption of renewables or faster than expected improvements in clean technologies could push energy costs down even more quickly than anticipated. While renewable power plants have quite high fixed costs, their operating costs are very low, owing to the zero cost of fuel, that is, wind and sunlight doesn't cost. The costs of wind and solar generated electricity have decreased markedly over the past decade, driven by technological innovation, as well as falling manufacturing and installation costs. Whatever the outcomes from this, trends in energy prices will have significant effects on overall inflation. This is because energy prices have a sizable direct impact on inflation, with retail electricity and gas prices accounting for around 3% of the consumer price index basket. There are also indirect effects, as businesses can be expected to gradually pass on higher energy costs to prices that consumers will pay for goods and services. So how the transition plays out for energy prices is going to be a very important consideration for monetary policy over coming years. When we think about the economic impacts of the transition to a lower emissions economy for Australia, we also need to consider the global dimension. Fossil fuels account for over a third of Australian exports, and most major Australian export markets have announced commitments to transition to net zero emissions. While the policies and the technology required to achieve these goals are in many places still being developed, in scenarios where net zero emissions is achieved by mid-century, there is a significant decline in demand for fossil fuels, including Australian coal exports. The 2023 Intergenerational Report shows that in a scenario where global action limits temperature risks to 1.5 degrees Celsius, the associated reduction in global demand for thermal coal could reduce Australia's exports to less than 1% of current levels by 2063. That's significant. So, as discussed earlier, there is significant uncertainty associated with these scenarios, including around the speed and the means by which countries make progress towards their net zero targets and future technological developments. Indeed, the key benchmark scenarios developed by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the International Energy Agency, and the Network for Greening the Financial System and others, there's actually significant variation in the speed and extent of coal phase-out in their scenarios. So you can get wildly different outcomes. The impact of declining global demand for Australia's fossil fuels on Australian exports could also be partly offset by opportunities in new low-emissions industries. For example, Australia has significant endowments of several of the minerals identified by the International Energy Agency as important inputs for energy transition. I include here cobalt, lead, lithium, nickel, vanadium, and zinc. These are all used in products like batteries, solar panels, and wind turbines. Global demand for lithium is projected to increase significantly over the next 40 years, expanding Australia's potential export market. Finally, the climate-related economic effects discussed may affect the bank's ability to assess the stance of monetary policy. This is because climate change might have important effects on an economy's capacity to produce goods and services. By that I mean it might have an impact on potential output. It might also affect the neutral interest rate and therefore how we assess the stance of monetary policy. Now, these two concepts, they're very difficult to assess in real time ordinarily in normal course, let alone when climate change is introducing additional variability and uncertainty. When demand and supply in the economy are in balance, there is no pressure on inflation to rise or fall. As I've discussed, extreme weather and higher temperatures could reduce the level or growth in the capital stock and labour productivity, lowering supply. The impact of transition to net zero emissions is less clear. The relative price changes due to mitigation policies could make parts of the capital stock economically obsolete, reducing supply at least until it is replaced. On the other hand, those same relative price changes will support capital accumulation and technological innovation associated with low emission activities, and that'll add to potential output. The neutral interest rate, well, this is the interest rate at which monetary policy is neither expansionary nor contractionary. It's not observable. It's sort of a conceptual benchmark for assessing the stance of policy. And the impact of climate change on the neutral interest rate is not clear-cut. In a world where significant climate risks materialise, Households might be likely to accumulate savings, firms might be less willing to invest, and this will put downward pressure on the neutral rate, and that will limit the effective monetary policy space available to policymakers, because the lower neutral interest rate will give us less room to lower interest rates if we need to. On the other hand, the extra investment required to replace capital stocks destroyed by more frequent national disasters or to transition to a lower emissions economy could put upward pressure on the neutral rate. So it's a bit ambiguous what's going to happen there. On a broader scale, there's a question about whether climate-related trends could cause central banks to re-examine the relative merits of flexible inflation targeting. So the RBA review that I mentioned earlier considered this question, but found that flexible inflation targeting had served the bank well and recommended its continued use. But I expect this debate about the framework for monetary policy and the target is likely to continue. So I want to switch now to talk a little bit about financial stability in the financial system. The physical and transition risks of climate change introduce both risks and opportunities for financial institutions. More intense weather events and higher average temperatures are likely to reduce the value of some assets and income streams. This could result in unexpected credit losses for banks, increased claims on insurers, and write-downs to the value of financial investments. If it's not adequately managed, there could be implications for the stability of the financial system. As part of the bank's mandate to contribute to the stability of the financial system, we're monitoring the build-up of climate-related risks. We're also working with members of the Council of Financial Regulators to create a framework for financial system participants to manage their climate-related risks and opportunities. Early analysis of climate-related risks to financial institutions, which was undertaken by the Australian Prudential Regulation, Australian regulators, we focused that on banks. Australian banks face climate risks primarily through their extensive exposure to residential mortgages. If climate change makes a home's location less desirable and significantly reduces its value, banks would then have less protection against default. Banks could also experience losses from transition risk associated with their exposure to carbon-intensive industries through their lending to businesses in those sectors. In analysis conducted by Reserve Bank staff, we used a macro-financial stress testing model to estimate how climate change might affect the banking sector using two scenarios, one with severe physical risks and the other with significant transition risks. To capture the physical climate risks to residential housing, we used climate hazard data and to measure the expected increase in insurance costs due to climate-related damage, such as more frequent flooding and more damaging cyclones. And these were translated then into housing price falls. And in this figure, you can see that around about 7.5% of properties are in postcodes that could see property prices decline by 5% or more due to climate change by 2050. Now, this analysis was done as a complement to the climate vulnerability assessment, which was led by the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority. They conducted this for the five largest banks over 2021 and 2022. Participating banks were provided with a high physical risk and a high transition risk scenario, similar to the one that we used, and they assessed the implications for themselves and their counterparties using internal models and processes. So the CVA, the Climate Vulnerability Assessment results, showed that losses on bank lending would increase in the medium to long term in both scenarios, but this wouldn't cause severe stress. This was largely because the lending losses were concentrated in specific regions and industries that represent only a small proportion of banks' overall lending exposures. So, do these results mean we don't need to worry about the impact of climate change on financial stability? Well, unfortunately, I'd say no. These are early exploratory exercises. They've only covered some aspects of climate risk and they're subject to a number of limitations. Firms and policymakers will need new and detailed data capturing varying effects of climate change across geographic locations and economic environments. And better reporting of climate risks will help. In addition, understanding climate risks has a forward-looking element, requiring the use of scenarios. More can be done to understand the range of possible outcomes, including looking at the distribution of outcomes, as well as the central tendency, and using a wider range of models, and finding ways to capture second round or spillover effects, rather than just the first order effects. The early work here has focused on banks, but other participants in the financial system will also feel impacts of climate change and require consideration. And the insurance sector is of particular interest here. Insurers are most directly affected by climate change because they offer protection to customers against natural disasters. Australian insurance payouts have been rising in real terms over the past few decades. This increase is less apparent when you adjust the claims for the cost of rebuilding and the geographic distribution of population across Australia. However, more frequent or more severe weather events are expected to increase claims on damaged property and other assets. In contrast to banks, insurance contracts are typically renewed annually, so insurers can adapt their business models more quickly to climate risks. They can pass on the cost to their customers in the form of higher premiums, or they may simply withdraw coverage from high-risk regions. So this manages the risk to the insurer, but it passes it back to the household or the business, or to the lenders in the case of loan defaults where affected assets are used as collateral. Indeed, the availability of insurance will influence the ability of businesses and households to recover from natural disasters, and hence it could amplify the overall economic impact of these events. To better understand the risks to the financial system that could occur due to changes in the cost and coverage of insurance, starting this year, APRA, the Prudential Regulation Authority, on behalf of the Council of Financial Regulators, will conduct a climate scenario analysis with insurers. More broadly, the members of the Council of Financial Regulators are working together to create a framework to enable participants in the financial system to manage their climate-related risks and opportunities, and this will support the transition to a lower emissions economy. A number of priorities, but they include supporting the Australian Government in the implementation of standardised, internationally aligned climate-related disclosure requirements for large businesses and financial institutions. We'll be overseeing the development of an Australian sustainable finance taxonomy and coordinated strategies to prevent greenwashing, and we'll be strengthening our international engagement on issues related to sustainable finance. So, in conclusion, climate change has macroeconomic implications that are relevant for the setting of monetary policy and the Reserve Bank's financial stability remit. There are some familiar elements. Monetary policy has always had to grapple with supply shocks, structural changes, and uncertainty. But some are new, in particular the heightened uncertainty around how climate will change and how this will impact the economy and the financial system. And changes are occurring over a prolonged time frame. They're not just a normal business or policy cycle. There's also uncertainty, of course, around the evolution of technology and the speed with which climate, economic and social systems can adapt. As a result, we have for some time been building the bank's capacity to conduct analysis and research into how climate change will affect the structure and operation of the economy and the implications for monetary policy. This has included analysis to understand the likely direction of structural change in the Australian economy and developments in energy markets. The Bank's liaison program has complemented our data analysis by providing information on firms' views on the likely direction of structural change and how this will impact firms and households. And we're also developing our capacity to model the macroeconomic implications of different types of climate risk for the economy and the setting of monetary policy. In addition, we're increasing our understanding of how climate risks might translate into financial stability risks. And as part of the Council of Financial Regulators, The bank's seeking to improve the ability of companies and investors to understand and price climate-related risks. We're also monitoring and analysing climate-related investment trends and their implications for the cost and availability of green and sustainable finance in Australia. Finally, we're actually examining and managing our own climate-related risks and opportunities. In line with the Australian Public Service net zero requirements, the bank has set a target to reduce our Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions to net zero by 2030. And we're also considering what sustainability and climate-related financial disclosures we can make, starting with operational emissions reporting in our 2022-23 annual report. So I'll stop there. Thank you for listening, and I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Michelle. My name is Simon Grant, and as Selwyn pointed out, I'm also a member of the Research School of Economics. I'll be moderating this question and answer session. We're allowing for about 20 minutes. I think to help facilitate things, it might help if you just quickly identify yourself and just wait until I acknowledge you, and Lucas will bring a microphone for you. Just remember, this is being recorded. And as my predecessor in this position, Martin Richardson, once said, it might aid things if what you say ends with a question mark, and that'll help Michelle. So, anyway, yeah. So, Lucas, just at the front here.
Thank you, Michelle. My name is
Swati.
I'm a journalist at Bloomberg News. So, two questions, if I can. One is, what's on your priority list when you take on as governor in 3 weeks' time? What would you like to tackle first? And secondly, earlier this month at Jackson Hole, we heard a whole bunch of central bankers talking about higher for longer interest rates globally. Do you have any views on what we can expect in Australia, if we are going to see interest rates staying high for a period of time, even here? Thank you.
Okay. On your second question, I hope you're not asking me to give forward guidance. on that point, I think all central banks at the moment are grappling with how much further they need to go. The persistence of inflation, particularly services, core services inflation, and whether or not they've done enough or whether there remains a little bit to be done. I'm reluctant to give any sort of predictions on how long interest rates might have to stay high. In Australia's case, all I can say is that we may have to raise interest rates again, but we're watching the data very carefully, and we'll be taking decisions for the time being until next year, at least month by month. So, on your first question, my priorities, probably unsurprising to say my first priority is to keep very focused on inflation. Inflation is still too high in Australia. It is coming down, and we're forecasting it to continue to come down, but it's still too high. So first priority is still to maintain a focus on bringing inflation back down to target. My second priority, as you know, the bank went through a review earlier this year, and there was a lot of changes recommended in that review, in particular changes to our monetary policy processes and frameworks. So there's a priority in bedding that down. But there's an equally important priority, which is to do with culture and leadership in the bank. And one very important focus for me over the next, when I take up duties for the next few months, is going to be working on getting action on that. Culture, getting a culture of sharing and debate and challenge and respectful challenge, I think. And that's something that I'm very, very passionate about, and I'm quite determined that that's one of my priorities.
Yep, Lucas.
Hi, my name is Angelica and I'm a student here at ANU. Firstly, thank you for a wonderful and very insightful, informative presentation. Second, I just wanted to ask, Obviously, climate has become a new hot topic, and I'm very grateful that, you know, it's gotten the attention of the RBA and we're finally addressing the risks that climate poses. But the fact is that climate is just one of many planetary boundaries that we're breaching at the moment. We've got issues of biodiversity loss, nutrient and phosphorus overflows, plastic pollution, and, you know, you can go on. Hmm. So how can our institutions, how can the RBA, how can we actually, you know, incorporate these issues from a holistic point of view into our solutions?
Thank you. Yeah, look, it's a very good question, and I think everyone is grappling with that. I think climate change and greening, if you like, has been the first priority, but increasingly what we're seeing is that governments, organisations are broadening themselves out to sustainability more broadly, which I would suggest incorporates all the sorts of things that you are talking about. We're less progressed on that sort of thing. But progress is being made. There are working on international sustainability standards, which are the sorts of things that, again, one of the first things we've got to get in these circumstances is transparency. We've got to have information about what, just like for example, taking the case of emissions, we need transparent information from companies on what their emissions footprint looks like. And we need the same sort of thing broadening out for sustainability. So I think we are moving in that direction. It is becoming more holistic, but it's true that much more work has been done on the greening side at the moment.
Good evening. Thank you for your lecture. Sabrina Diaz, CSIRO, postdoctoral researcher. More than 50 years ago, we had the publication Limits to Growth, and current scenarios show that relative decoupling would not help us meet the Paris Agreement targets. You spoke about scenario and scenario analysis. So my question is, do you think that we should include in the scenario analysis and relative policies limits to growth consideration and measure of economic prosperity that would go beyond GDP growth?
If I interpret your question correctly, you're asking whether or not GDP is an appropriate measure to consider the impacts of climate change. Is that your question? So I think the government is actually doing a little bit of work on this at the moment. I mean, it's GDP is sort of the best thing we've got at the moment, I think. The government is doing a little bit of work on this topic of whether or not you can broaden out a consideration of what matters, if you like, to a country. I think, though, in terms of the scenarios we're doing at the moment, in terms of monetary policy, I think the relevance, the importance actually rests in GDP. It's in demand and supply, because that's what influences inflation. So I think from our perspective, the focus still remains on production and supply.
Thank you, Michelle. Hi, John Keogh here from the Australian Financial Review. The pre-pandemic era was sort of characterised by a lot of positive supply shocks in the economy, globalisation, technology, the entry of millions of people from Chinese and other developing economies into the global labour market. Now, we seem to be tackling or dealing with negative supply shocks, such as the ones you've outlined in your speech on climate, the energy transition. Now, your former supervisor at the London School of Economics has also spoken about the great demographic reversal as being another negative supply shock, with China peaking, its working age population shrinking, globalisation going to reverse. So, do you think that there is a risk that with these negative supply shocks we are heading for a world of higher structural inflation and therefore higher policy rates?
No, I don't think necessarily. To your point, and the current governor has spoken about this before, to the extent that our productivity isn't growing as quickly as it has in the past, because some of these factors that you've mentioned, it does mean that to bring inflation down, it means that we need wages growing at a slower pace than they have in the past. So it's it does have implications, if you like, for lower productivity, smaller pie, less for people to take a bite of the pie. And so I think that's the main influence there, is that we need to get productivity up. And some of those influences that might be bringing it down, I think we need to lean into policies that improve productivity, increase the size of the pie, and that means more for everyone, Australian society, to consume.
So, question at the back.
You mentioned you had a chart there with housing prices and their effect, the fiscal risk and how that will affect them across Australia. It was interesting that it was mainly concentrated in areas that are highly dependent on commodity exports like WA and Queensland. Will that, together with the lower demand for those commodities, given the transition to zero emissions and so forth, will that amplify the overall effect? And what is the associated risk from that for economic growth and price stability?
I think, if I interpret your question correctly, I think what you're talking about is the potential impact of structural change and the impact that's going to have on workforces that work in particular areas. It's true that if you have climate change and it's impacting different regions in different ways, then, as I said earlier, some local communities are going to be affected much more than others. And the flexibility of the labour market to move to where the jobs are and get the skills that they need, that's going to be really important in that context.
So maybe just a couple more questions at the back there, side.
Hi, I'm Sachin. Thank you so much for your wonderful lecture. I'm an economic student. I just had some questions about the labour market and unemployment. Obviously, RBA has a mandate on inflation, but is specifically interested also in the labour market. How do you think climate change will affect labour productivity, structural unemployment, and potentially even Australia's area?
So there is a suggestion that climate change, and the intergenerational report highlighted that with climate change and rising temperatures, it's quite possible that labour productivity in some industries will decline. And it's quite possible that if potential output is lowered, that unemployment will be higher. So but that doesn't mean that we have to accept those circumstances. There can be policies. There's lots of work going to be generated in areas which are new technologies, new areas, new low emissions industries, which there'll be a need for labour. So there's going to be a really important role in making sure that we can retrain, move labour from areas where perhaps it's not valued anymore or it's not useful, and moving it to areas where it is. So there's a role for government policy here. And look, this won't happen overnight. There might well be frictions and pains as we end up with this structural shift. But if you look back over the history and you look at the way technology moves on, the example I used to use, the typing pool. When I started work, there was a typing pool of something like 50 people typing. We don't have them anymore. They do other things. So people will move ultimately. There might be some short-term disruption, but ultimately I think there's a role for government in making sure that people can move from areas where perhaps the jobs that they used to have in the high emissions areas are no longer there, and how do we move them into areas where they're now in demand.
So we'll just take then two more questions after that, and then we'll wrap it up.
Thank you, Michelle. Just Jared from the ATO. So I was curious, we spoke a bit about how insurers were going to change their appetite for risks I wanted to know, has there already been a change in the appetite for risk from the banking sector and how they could manage more risky investments that are affected by climate change?
I don't think the banks have necessarily changed their appetite for risk. They're not. I think one of the things that came out of the CVA is they're not really highly exposed to the high emissions areas. But I think it's increasingly likely that as climate change starts to bite more, that they might start to look more closely at their portfolios. But at the moment, I think they're not actually heavily exposed to these areas.
So one more question here and then the last question up there.
Hello. Thanks a lot for your lecture. I'm Sid over here. I was just wondering, as the lecture is more focused on climate change, do you have any comments on modern monetary theory paying for the Green New Deal?
I'd only say that no particular comments on that, but I would say that I think the traditional approach at the moment, our framework for monetary policy, is very much one of using monetary policy to control the interest rate, which impacts financial conditions, hence demand, and hence inflation. I wouldn't have any comments on monetary theory to be used for greening, no.
So, Lucas, if we can just have the final question.
Hi, Deputy Governor Melissa Coe from the Mandarin, and thanks for your talk. You referred to tipping points and irreversible change in this potentially dire future scenario. I'm just curious to know, in your mind, when it comes to the debate around flexible inflation target and the extent to which that guides monetary policy, what are the flashpoints economically or in terms of climate change that are likely to shape that debate?
Flashpoints. So, there's nothing monetary policy can do about any of that. All monetary policy can do, as I said earlier, is try and maintain low and stable inflation, price stability, because that then allows businesses and governments to make decisions associated with the transition to a low emissions economy with much more certainty, without worrying about inflation. So I don't think there's much in that particular issue for monetary policy itself. Doesn't mean there isn't something in it for others, but our job to keep inflation low and stable is very important in that context, to allow others to get on with decision making with a minimum of uncertainty about inflation.